The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. I'm coming to you live from our newly improved studio in Edstone, England. We've been doing some upgrades while Mr. Flurry is away, and I think these are probably, cosmetically at least, some of the biggest that we've done. He'll come back and not recognise the place. It is a slight bit of a construction site. We're not quite finished yet, but I'm excited about what we'll be able to do when it's finished. We've got a new computer monitor mounted on the wall here now, which Sam, our producer, can push things over to. It should give us a few more options with the program. It should make interviews a lot easier, a lot simpler to set up for, so we'll have a much better setup for interacting with headquarters for things like Trumpet Hour. As I said, though, we've still got a few things to try and get sorted out for next week. And for today's show, I wanted to do something a little different than go over some news articles of the week, partly because a lot of newspapers, and especially in Europe, aren't actually publishing news articles this week. And to get us started, here's a clip from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry in the latest Key of David.
First of all, we have to understand that men didn't make America great in the first place, nor did they make Britain great in the first place. God did that. Those are the two birthright nations that we talk about. And if you don't understand about who the birthright nations are and who Israel is, you need to write and request our book by phone if you can. Whatever way you want to request it, you just about can do that. But it is the United States and Britain in prophecy, and we offer it all the time. But God is what is the one that should be given credit for that, and we don't really give God credit for that today, but this new book of mine will explain that to you and show you why what these commentators and writers are talking about is really just slightly getting into the issue that we need to get into, and that is looking to God.
Make America great again. That's got to be one of the biggest slogans to have come out of 2016. And that soundbite touches on a theme Mr. Flurry's brought up a few times on that. You know, if you want to know how to make America great again, you have to know how America was made great in the first place. And that's what I'd like to cover on today's program. It also dovetails nicely with something we've just been covering in international relations class here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, and that is what makes a nation great. What are the factors that go into national power? Why are some nations strong and some nations weak? What are the differences? And the textbook we use for that class is a book called Politics Among Nations by Hans J. Morgenthau, and he goes through 9 factors that he lists that go into national greatness, that make a nation great. And you could probably enumerate things a little differently, but in general, there's quite strong agreement that these are the factors that go into national power, that make a nation great. And so this is one way we can look at what made America great. And then that really helps us answer the question, okay, well, if that's what made America great in the first place, how do we make America great again? And when you look at these 9 factors and you apply them to, they apply to Britain as well, but to Britain and to America, and you compare them with what's in the Bible, there is a powerful lesson for us there. And when you look at where America got all these factors from, where these elements of power that made America great came from, it becomes very clear that there is a God in command working out history according to his plan. But then these 9 points, they also have a clear warning as we get towards the end about how these factors that make up America's greatness can be taken away. But before we get into Morgenthau's 9 points, there's just a couple of other things we need to understand. And one is that when you look at the Old Testament and you look at the blessings and the promises made to the nations of Israel then, all of that applies to modern Britain and America. And because this is so foundational of what we're talking about today, I'll just take a couple of minutes to review that or introduce that to you in case you've never heard it before. And I'll start with Genesis chapter 22 and verse 15. And this is, early in the book of Genesis, God makes a series of promises to Abraham. And earlier in Abraham's life, we hear God saying, well, if you obey me, I'll do this and this and this. I'll make you these promises. But in Genesis chapter 22, Abraham proved his complete obedience. He was willing to sacrifice his son Isaac. And so in verse 22, God says, and the angel of the Eternal called out to Abraham out of heaven the second time and said, by myself have I sworn, said the Eternal, because you have done this thing and has not withheld your son, your only son, that in blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your seed. So, and then he goes and reviews, gives some of those same promises. But here God gives those promises to Abraham. He says, I'm going to do these things, no conditions. These blessings will be fulfilled. And these blessings come in two categories. There's promises of a Messiah to come, of spiritual salvation. But then there are promises that very clearly apply to a physical nation. Now, we fast forward to a chapter that we'll spend a fair bit of time in today, Leviticus chapter 26, a chapter that goes a long way to describing Britain's greatness, America's greatness, explaining why they're great, as we'll see. At the beginning of that chapter, Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 3, God says to ancient Israel, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, and then lays out a series of promises. So God said to Abraham, you know, I swear by myself, I'm going to give you and your descendants these blessings. No ifs, no buts, it's going to happen. And yet here God says to ancient Israel, well, if you obey, this is what's going to happen. So how do you match that up, the conditional promises to Abraham with these unconditional promises? I mean, unconditional promises to Abraham with these conditional promises to ancient Israel. Well, that's exactly what Mr. Armstrong talks about in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And he writes, God was bound by his promise to confer this stupendous national blessing regardless of the righteousness or wickedness of the descendants, but God had not bound himself to bestow it upon any one particular generation. Thus God was able to offer it conditionally to Old Testament Israel in and after Moses' day. The people of these generations could have it upon compliance with the conditions. So for ancient Israel, it was conditional. If you obey me, if you keep my commandments, but they did not meet those conditions. And so ancient Israel did not receive those full promises of just superpower status and greatness then. But in that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Mr. Armstrong goes over how the Bible says, well, if they rejected God, that those blessings would be withheld 2,520 years. That's something we don't really have time to get into today, but it's just an amazing study. If and when you do have time to do that, I mean, if you want to make history come alive, that is really something to go dig in and study, because all of history revolves so much around that promise, around this delayed promise of greatness and when it would be fulfilled. And if you want to know more about this subject, read our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, a prophecy that really does go into all of this in far more detail than I can today, a book that really proves that God has a plan and that he's working out these details here. I'm just very quickly skimming over this to set a foundation for what we're talking about, but there's lots of details in that book that you can use to really prove this for yourself. But that's the foundation for what I want to talk about today. God made those great and very specific promises to the descendants of Abraham. Those descendants today are Britain and America, and that's proved in that book. And they began to receive those blessings, those promises, in the year 1800, 2,520 years exactly, almost pretty much, well, exactly after they went into captivity in ancient times. And that's a very, very quick overview, but you can prove all of that from our book, our free book, that you can get for free from thetrumpet.com, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And if there's any doubt in your mind about this, well, stay with me for just a few minutes and we'll look at the blessings that God promised. And we'll look at America's history, America's geography, the things that have gone into making America great. And we'll see just how closely It all matches up. So what then makes a nation great? What are some of the things that lead to national greatness? Well, the first point that Morgenthau makes, the first piece that he lists off, is geography. He writes, "The most stable factor upon which the power of a nation depends is obviously geography." A bit later he writes, "On the relatively stable foundation of geography, the pyramid of national power rises through different gradients of instability." And this is a factor that very obviously God controls. He created the earth. We'll just read very quickly Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8, which states, "When the Most High divided the nations, their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel." So when God determined the earth's geography and which nation ended up where, he did that with the nations of Israel in mind. He had these promises to Abraham in mind, and you can read more about God just being in control of national borders in Acts 17 and verse 26. And Roy Schultz, who wrote one of the textbooks that the Worldwide Church of God used in their Imperial Academy, he wrote, "God determines the bounds of nations. He determined in advance where the nations and races should live and the part each should play in ancient as well as more recent times." And that's something those scriptures show. And regardless of these more specific prophecies in Genesis, etc., anyone who believes that God is working out a plan here below, as Winston Churchill says, well, they have to believe that God had a say in the earth's geography. After all, he created it. So what does America's geography do for America's power? Some years ago, George Friedman, who was working then at Stratfor, now at Geopolitical Futures, just an excellent news analyst, he produced a fairly lengthy paper on exactly this subject, and it's available to read for free on Stratfor's website, and it's called "The Geopolitics of the United States, the Inevitable Empire." And that's the way this great expert on international relations sees it. America's geography is so great that it was inevitable that they would become a world power. And here's what he writes. "The American geography is an impressive one. The Greater Mississippi Basin, together with the Intercoastal Waterway, has more kilometers of navigable internal waterways than the rest of the world combined." That's just an amazing statistic. More kilometers of navigable waterways in America than in the entire rest of the world combined. "The American Midwest is both overlaid by this waterway and is the world's largest contiguous piece of farmland." Another just amazing statistic or fact about the gifts that America's geography is to it. Moving on, "The U.S. Atlantic coast possesses more major ports than the rest of the Western Hemisphere combined." Another incredible factor of geography America is blessed with. "Two vast oceans insulate the United States from Asian and European powers. Deserts separate the United States from Mexico to the south, while lakes and forests separate the population centers in Canada from those in the United States. The United States has capital, food surpluses, and physical insulation in excess of every other country in the world by an exceedingly large margin." So those are some huge advantages that America's been blessed with from its geography that makes America, in Friedman's opinion, an inevitable empire. Why is America great? Well, you can get a good part of the way right there. America is great because of the geography that God blessed them with. And Mr. Morley, Sir Robert Morley, who used to teach international relations, he gave a whole program on geography that you can go back and listen to last year. I meant to look up the title. If we had our monitor working, which we don't quite yet, I could get Sam to push the title over to me. We'll have to get that up and running for next week. But he gave a whole program, and really on all of these nine factors, you could give a whole program on each of them, just showing how God has blessed America in those areas, and in many of the cases, as we'll see towards the end of the show, how God is withdrawing those blessings. But there's also something to be said of just kind of getting the overview and seeing just how many of these different ways America's power depends upon all of these blessings that they've received from God. One of these specific blessings, if we look in Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 6, God says, "And I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid, and I will rid evil beasts out of the land, and neither shall the sword go through your land." And look how America's geography has enabled that. And this is true as well for Britain, separated from Europe by the narrow English Channel, a channel that's just wide enough to make it hard for armies to get across there. But America is just separated by these huge bodies of water, 3,000 miles wide in the east, more than 6,000 miles in the west. And look at how often European countries have been crisscrossed by armies, even just in the 20th century. But during that time, Britain hasn't. America hasn't. America, even unlike Britain, escaped the large-scale bombings of World War II because of that insulation of geography and that security of that geographic blessing. Another quote from the same article by Friedman talks about the greater Mississippi is the continent's core, and whoever controls that core is not only certain to dominate the East Coast and Great Lake region, but will also have the agricultural, transport, trade, and political unification capacity to be a world power, even without having to interact with the rest of the global system. And just more specifically on this point that we've just talked about, he writes that the United States could exist in relative peace for its first few decades without needing to worry about any large-scale, omnipresent military or economic challenges. So it did not have to garrison a large military. Every scrap of energy the young country possessed could be spent on making itself more sustainable. When viewed together, the robust natural transport network, overlaying vast tracts of excellent farmland, sharing a continent with two much smaller and weaker powers, it is inevitable that whoever controls the middle third of North America will be a great power. And we'll continue to see the advantages bestowed upon America with its geography as we move on to the next item that Morgenthau outlines as a key or as an element of power, and that is natural resources. And here he devotes most of his time to certain specifics, and the first natural resource that he identifies as being important for national power is food. And this too is something very specifically promised to the modern nations of Britain, to America, in the Bible. Again, still with Leviticus chapter 26, it says, "Then I will give you rain in due season, and the land shall yield her increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And your threshing shall reach unto the vintage, and the vintage unto the sowing time. And you shall eat your bread to the full, and dwell in your land safely." And this is something you can see repeated in several different occasions. It's also over in Deuteronomy 28, a chapter we'll go to later. And we've already seen just how amazingly America has been blessed in this regard. Like we've quoted already, the American Midwest is the most productive and the largest continuous acreage of arable land on the planet. That's a direct fulfillment of these promises of great blessings in Leviticus chapter 26. God promised great amounts of food. America has had a superabundance of food throughout the height of its power. And then more than just incredibly fertile farmland, going back to the same Friedman article, he writes, "Even in modern times, Russian and Kazakh crops occasionally rot before they can reach market. Massive artificial transport networks must be constructed and maintained in order for the land to reach its full potential. Not so in the case of the greater Mississippi Basin. The vast bulk of the prime agricultural lands are within 200 kilometers of a stretch of navigable rivers. Roads and rail are still used for collection, but nearly omnipresent river ports allow for the entirety of the basin's farmers to easily and cheaply ship their products to markets, not just in North America, but all over the world." So you have this, in Russia, you have certain areas of really abundant farmland, but they don't coincide with useful navigable rivers and easy ways to get that food to the rest of the nation's population. That's not the case in America. This world's largest, more navigable waterways than the rest of the world combined, happen in exactly the same location as the world's largest contiguous piece of arable farmland, meaning that you have a huge amount of food that you can easily transport and feed your people. Exactly the kind of blessings that God promised in Leviticus 26. The next set of natural resources that Morgenthau points to are raw materials. and in his book The United States and Britain in Prophecy, Mr. Armstrong detailed some major impressive statistics about the raw material wealth that America and Britain also, more previously, have been blessed with. So he writes here, world petroleum output in 1950 was almost, basically 3.8 billion barrels. Of this total, the United States alone produced more than one half, nearly 52%. Then Britain and America mined 1.5 times as much coal as all other nations combined. Another statistic together, the British Commonwealth and America produced in 1950 3/4 of the world's steel. Another one, we produced 1.3 times as much pig iron as all other nations combined. Some more stats, we possess nearly 95% of the world's nickel, chiefly from Canada, 80% of the world's aluminium, 75% of the world's zinc. Some more together, Britain and America produced 2/3 of the world's rubber and dominated the world's copper, lead, tin, bauxite, and other precious metal outputs. And as he points to there, this has already gone down. Britain and America no longer, even by the 1960s, dominated those areas and that natural resource production as they used to. But still, there was just a huge blessing in natural abundance to both those powers. And one thing that I think is just really fascinating, if you look in the prophecies of the Bible, it seems clear that God intended that Britain to rise up as a superpower first, and then America to kind of take over afterwards. And Britain doesn't really, we don't have a huge amount of natural resources here, especially compared to just the vast number of natural resources in the huge area of the United States. Britain's a small island. But what do we have in abundance? Iron and coal. And what were the two vital natural resources for being a major power in the 19th century? Iron and coal. Without those two, Britain couldn't have become a major industrial power. So Britain just happened to have just the two raw materials necessary to rise in power at exactly the point in time that God prophesied the nation would rise in power. It's a bit of a digression, but to get back to Morgenthau and his components of national power, the next item that he points to is industrial capacity. And by this he means, just to quote, the quality and productive capacity of the industrial plant, the know-how of the working man, the skill of the engineer, the inventive genius of the scientist, the managerial organization. All of these are factors upon which the industrial capacity of a nation and hence its power depends. So he's basically talking about the things that the ability to take raw materials and turn them into finished output. And this is important. Lots of nations have raw materials but are not great powers. Africa, for example, is full of raw materials, but there are a few nations that would be considered, well, no nations really, that would be considered major powers there. And Morgenthau gives the example of India, and he writes that it will not and talks about how it's got many of these other aspects of national power, but he writes it will not become a great power so long as it is lacking in other factors without which no nation in modern times can attain the status of a great power. Of these factors, industrial capacity is one of the most important. I should point out that Morgenthau wrote his book quite a few years ago, and India has industrialized a lot since then. But just going back to the importance of industrial capacity to national power, he writes, thus it is inevitable that the leading industrial nations should be identified or should be identical with the great powers, and a change in industrial rank, for better or worse, should be accompanied or followed by a corresponding change in the hierarchy of power. A bit further down, he writes, this drastic increase in the importance of industrial capacity for national power has also accentuated the traditional distinction between great and small powers. The very term superpower points to an unprecedented accumulation of power in the hands of a very few nations, which sets these nations apart from smaller ones, but also from the traditional great powers as well. What distinguishes the superpowers from all other nations, aside from their ability to wage all-out nuclear war and to absorb a less-than-all-out nuclear attack, is their virtual industrial self-sufficiency and their technological capacity to stay abreast of other nations. So industrial capacity is a major item that goes into making a nation a superpower. And again, we see America greatly blessed by God in this regard. And then even, actually, we'll go now to Deuteronomy 28. There are a few specific promises here. I said Deuteronomy 28. I don't mean... Oh, I'm trying to turn to 38. That's why. Deuteronomy 28. And we'll see some specific prophecies that touch on this aspect as well. So Deuteronomy 28 and verse 3 says, "Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the field." So a blessing in agricultural production, but also that the activities of the city will be blessed. And in verse 8 it says, "Blessed shall you be when you come in, blessed shall you be when you go out." And Clark Commentary writes, "Your way shall be made prosperous before you. You shall have divine blessing in all your labors." And then again in verse 8 it says, "The Eternal shall command the blessings upon you in your storehouse and in all that you set your hand unto." So everything that you work on to produce, which would certainly include industrial capacity, will be blessed. And has America been blessed in all that it sets its hand to do in this regard? Well, going back to the United States and Britain in prophecy, Mr. Armstrong writes, "We produce and utilize 2/3 of the world's output of electricity. The United States producing 283 billion kilowatt hours in 1948, and the United Kingdom and Canada outstripping Russia, Germany, and France combined." And he goes on to talk about just how much of the world merchant fleet tonnage the US owned as well. So this has been another characteristic that Britain and America really stand out. You had the Industrial Revolution begin in Britain, and at the start of the 1800s, there was an explosion in industrial capacity, and you saw the same kind of thing in the mid-20th century within America. And by the mid-20th century, it was just a huge aspect. There's a quote from Morgenthau, quoting from an article The Economist wrote in 1947, saying, "The United States, even before Hitler's war, far outstripped every other nation in the world in material strength, in scale and of industrialization, weight of resources, standard of living, by every index of output and consumption." And that's something we saw clearly demonstrated in World War II. We've recently had the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and that was a major hit lost to the US at the time. But once that big industrial machine was turned towards war, America made every 2 days the same number of planes that she lost at Pearl Harbor. In just 2 days. In 1994, Germany built 40,000 airplanes. America made more than double that, 100,000. And this too is an area, but this is an area now we already see being taken away, being cut back. In the United States and Britain in prophecy, Mr. Armstrong, he was using data from the 1960s showing that America no longer had the same super dominance in industrial capacity that it used to have. And we'll see, we won't turn there quite yet, but we'll get there soon in Isaiah 3, where God lists punishments that will bring upon his people if they don't obey him at the end time. Well, he lists the people that he will take away, and one of them is the cunning artificer, the skilled craftsman, the great industrialist who produces things. And there's so much evidence of America's industrial capacity receding. I had some statistics from an article Mr. Morley wrote in 2006 called The Death of American Manufacturing, but I'll just leave you to look those up as I am starting to get a little behind time. And as I said, really each of these sections could be an entire program on their own. So we've looked at geography, natural resources, industrial capacity. The next factor that Morgenthau lists is military preparedness. And if we turn back to Leviticus 26, we'll see a quick promise about this. And this is a military victory is another promise that's listed repeatedly. Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 6 says, "And I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. I will rid evil beasts out of the land, neither shall the sword go through the land. And you shall chase your enemies, and they shall fall before you by the sword, and 5 of you shall chase 100, 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall by the sword." And there's lots to talk about here in terms of American military victories, but I'll just give one example, and that's the same that Friedman points to in his essay on America's geography. And he was writing about the Texas Revolution, when Mexican General Santa Anna invaded Texas with the famous siege of the Alamo. And he writes, it was in this war that one of the most important battles of the modern age was fought. After the capture of the Alamo, Mexican dictator General Antonio López de Santa Anna marched north and then east with the intention of smashing the Texan forces in a series of engagements. With the Texans outnumbered by a factor of more than 5-1, there was every indication that the Mexican forces would prevail over the Texan rebels. But with no small amount of luck, that's what he put it, it was luck, but with no small amount of luck, the Texans managed to not only defeat the Mexican forces at the Battle of San Jacinto, I'm probably butchering that, but also capture Santa Anna himself and force a treaty of succession upon the Mexican government. And then he writes, however, had the battle gone the other way, the Texan forces would not have simply been routed, but crushed. It was obvious to the Mexicans that the Texans had been fighting with weapons made in the United States, purchased from the United States, with money lent by the United States. Since there would have been no military force between the Mexican army and New Orleans, it would not have required a particularly ingenious plan for Mexican forces to capture New Orleans. It could well have been Mexico, not the United States, that controlled access to the North America Corps. But Mexican supremacy over North America was not to be, and the United States continued consolidating. So you had this battle, he called it, and it's one I barely even heard of before, but one that he called it one of the most important battles of the modern age. The Texans, backed by the United States, outnumbered 5-1. Had the battle gone differently, Mexico, they would have captured New Orleans, they would have controlled the gateway to that whole Midwest river system that's so important. That world's largest contiguous piece of farmland would then have probably fallen to Mexican control, and Mexico could well have ended up being the superpower, not the United States. But it was, in Friedman's word, he called it no small amount of luck that led to Texas winning this battle despite being outnumbered 5-1. So a fulfilled promise here of victory in military against much larger odds, and I'm sure we'd see more of those five chasing 100 that it talks about here had the nation relied more on God. But we can certainly see the hand, God's hand in giving America these key military victories repeatedly, and this is just one example. But now we're starting to see, again, another area of these blessings removed. Mr. Stephen Flory did a program just a few weeks ago about how, you know, quoting quite a few different articles, talking about how America isn't winning victories anymore. This isn't happening anymore. There are none of these outnumbered five to one, winning with no small amount of luck. We know, of course, it's not luck. And Morgenthaler, he points to the importance of leadership He writes that aside from the timely use of technological innovation, the quality of military leadership has always exerted a decisive influence on national power. And we'll go over to Isaiah chapter 3 now. And this, as I mentioned earlier, is a chapter where God lists the type of individuals, the type of leaders who will take away from the nation if it does not obey him, does not turn to him. And it says, for behold, the Lord, the Eternal of hosts, doth take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread, the whole stay of water, the mighty man, the man of war. So the mighty man and the man of war, the military leaders, so essential for military power. The judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient, the captain of 50. So again, military leaders on a smaller scale. All taken away. We won't turn back there right now, but in Leviticus 26 and 19, when God lists the curses for disobedience, he says that he'll break the pride of your power. And there's still power there. There is still military power. There's a lot of military hardware. But God is taking away the will to use it. And a lot of that, it comes from the leadership. There are no great leaders, and overall military policy is flawed. And we'll get to some more of that a bit later. But the next item that Morgenthaler identifies as being an important aspect of national power is population. He writes, it is still true that no country can remain or become a first-rate power which does not belong to the more populous nations of the earth. Without a large population, it is impossible to establish and keep going the industrial plant necessary for the successful conduct of modern war, to put in the field large number of combat troops, etc. There's quite a few other things listed there. And he writes, the United States, a bit further down, in an area between that of size between that of Australia and Canada, has a population of 234 million, more than 15 times larger than Australia's and nearly 10 times larger than Canada's. With the population of either Australia or Canada, the United States could never have become the most powerful nation on Earth. So a large population is another crucial factor in America becoming a major power. And again, this is another very specific promise blessing from God. And we'll go back, we even saw it earlier when we were reading from Genesis 22, but if we go back to Leviticus 26 and verse 9, it says, "For I will have respect unto you and make you fruitful and multiply you." So a promise of a large population. And we saw exactly that. And in the 19th century, in the run-up to America exploding as a superpower, there was a population explosion. Going back to Morgenthau, he writes, in 1824, the population of the United States was close to 11 million. By 1874, it had risen to 44 million. By 1924, 114 million. And some of that was around 30 to 40% of that growth came from immigration, but it was also, just a population explosion. And he writes that as the shifts in the distribution of power within Europe in recent history have been roughly duplicated by the changes of population trends, so the emergence of the United States as the great power of the power center of the West, taking the place of Western and Central Europe, can be read in the population figures of the respective countries. In 1870, the population of France as well as Germany exceeded that of the United States. Yet in 1940, the population of the United States had increased by 100 million, while the combined increase of the population of France and Germany in the same period amounted to only 31 million. So a specific promise of population growth fulfilled and playing a key role in American national power. And you saw exactly, and really I could give this entire same program about the factors that went into the rise of Britain, and you saw the same kind of population explosion in the 1700s leading to, and especially the late 1700s, leading to Britain emerging as a great power. Now the next section that Morgenthau goes into, the next character aspect of national element of national power, is national character. This is something I'll mostly skip over for today's program. It is important and may well be the subject of a later program, and Morgenthau really makes some great points here. But the existence of different national characteristics, it is controversial these days. It would take some time to prove it. And then Morgenthau, if anything, he kind of argues that some aspects of America's national power actually hold them back, or elements of national character. So national character is important. We will leave that for a subject for another day, though. And so the next element of national power that we'll get into, that he talks about, is national morale. And so this then is basically, well, how well will people stand up in the crisis? Are they going to work together and tough it out, or are they going to collapse, stage revolts against the government, argue with each other? He writes that national morale is the degree of determination with which a nation supports the foreign policy of its governments at peace and war. And that he talked about just how essential it is. It's about having the nation unified and supporting what the government is doing. And there are times in history where nations suffered great defeat, suffered a defeat and just kind of broke, like France in 1940 surrendering, or Russia after many defeats in 1917 disintegrating into revolution. But then there are other times when exactly the same nations went through incredible hardship without breaking, like Russia in 1812 or in 1942. So a major factor, sometimes this factor is described as will. And as we get into some of these less stable elements of national power, where these things can change more quickly, we can see these are some areas where America and Britain were great in the past, but are being cursed today. And one point Morgenthau makes is that deep divisions within a nation destroy national morale. He writes, whenever deep dissensions tear a people apart, the popular support that can be mustered for a foreign policy will always be precarious and will be actually small if the success or failure of the foreign policy has a direct bearing upon the issues of domestic struggle. He writes that any country with deep and unbridgeable class divisions will find its national morale in a precarious state. And he gives the example of France before World War II, where there were such deep divisions that one segment of French society hated the other more and opposed the other more than it hated and opposed Hitler. And he talks about how those deep divisions just really led to a lot of weakness. And he towards the end of the section, that he says anything that tends to split the national community into warring groups, or the national morale, is likely to be low. And look at America today. And this is one of the things we talked about on our year in review on Trumpet Hour yesterday. The division in the United States. So many people have been talking about it and writing about this, especially since the election. One of the best, of course, though, in the January issue of the Trumpet, Mr. Gerald Flurry had an article called America's Coming Civil War. In it, he wrote, Americans are becoming their own worst enemies. What do you think our enemies abroad will do? He writes that many Americans are troubled by the divisions and hatreds being expressed right now, but they need to be a lot more concerned than they are. These problems are going to get worse and worse until people get the message and they learn why these disasters are happening. And these deep divides really undermine American power. Now, Morgenthau also points to leadership as being a key factor in national morale. And he makes the point, well, there are lots of other things that are involved, but the quality of government is the easiest thing for a government to address and change. The other aspects, they're much harder for a government to try and fix. But a great leader can unify people, can raise morale, can rally people behind a national goal. And look at the effect that Winston Churchill had, or Abraham Lincoln. And now, think back to what we read about in Isaiah 3, about God taking away the eloquent orator, the kind of leader that can really unify people and raise morale. God says he's taking away that kind of good governance, those great leaders. And as Morgenthau says, this leads to a collapse in morale, and that's an important factor of national power. Now, the next factor that Morgenthau gets to is the quality of diplomacy. And again, this is another one that could easily be an entire program. And what he means by diplomacy here, he says, we refer to the formation and execution of foreign policy on all levels. So the president and the secretary of state setting foreign policy, and then the way those under him and the diplomats, etc., carry it out. And he makes so many points, great points, about the quality of diplomacy and its importance in this section. He writes that of all factors that make for the power of a nation, the most important factor, however unstable, is the quality of diplomacy. All other factors that determine national power are, as it were, the raw material out of which the power of a nation is fashioned. The quality of a nation's diplomacy combines those different factors into an integrated whole, gives them direction and weight, and awakens their slumbering potentialities by giving them the breath of actual power. The conduct of a nation's foreign policy by its diplomats is for national power and peace, what military tactics and strategies by military leaders for national power in times of war. He writes that diplomacy, one might say, is the brains of national power. The vision is blurred, its judgment defected, determination feeble. All these other advantages that he went over, they're going to avail a nation little. He says, in the long run, the nation will just squander its assets. Often in history, he writes, the Goliath without brains or soul has been smitten and slain by the David who had both. So diplomacy, just a vital factor in national power. But how is American diplomacy? Well, we have stories about the policy of America's diplomacy every day on this program. You see more and more foreign policy experts and leaders around the world saying, well, just where is America? Russia's being really assertive, and they have a clear purpose in their diplomacy. They know what they're doing, whereas America is confused and disinterested. We see this at the top very often. One way that we may be less, what doesn't make our news as much, but is very important, is just the actual quality of American diplomatic service, which has now become, in so many ways, just a way of rewarding friends. Many people are just appointed diplomats because of their ability to raise funds, well, as a reward for raising funds for a victorious presidential candidate. So we've got things like TV executives or tech entrepreneurs been made ambassadors just because they raised a lot of money for Mr. Obama. And every administration, this isn't just Mr. Obama, just about every administration has done this kind of thing. the Chicago Tribune about a year or two ago, they had an article pointing at some of these congressional hearings for these kind of diplomats and showing that these diplomats, they didn't really have a clue about the nations they were going to. And as that article pointed out, they were given access to all kind of help from the American foreign policy establishment before going into these hearings, but they didn't seem like they bothered to learn anything. And they write that the inability to respond to simple questions would appear to evince a lack of interest in the task at hand. It's as if they flunked an open book exam they were allowed to take home. We'll talk a bit more about this section in a minute, but first I'll just introduce the final factor that Morgenthau identifies, and that is quality of government. Quality of government. And this is really about rallying the people around the foreign around a foreign policy, choosing a foreign policy that gets the people behind it, choosing the right type of foreign policies. It gives the example of Jimmy Carter as someone who did this poorly, who simply followed public opinion at the time, ended up with a disastrous foreign policy, and then ended up becoming very unpopular because of it. And he talks in this chapter about how Mr. Carter responded with just belligerent talk to the crisis in the world, but no action. And that describes exactly what America does today. Now, another way that we can see America, or quality of government, really helping America in terms of national power is the Constitution. America was supremely blessed in this area initially with the Constitution. As Mr. Flurry wrote in his book No Freedom Without Law, the Constitution was based to a great extent on God's law. That is why I believe it is the most noble document ever written by a government of this world. What a rare document he is, he wrote. Our forefathers had this awesome opportunity to establish the rule of God in the wealthiest country ever. So they established a constitution to protect us from the extremes of human reason. Tyrants, unjust judges, biased leaders were controlled by this law. And so the principles not from this constitution come from the Bible, this idea of rule of law, etc. And this constitution set the basis of a form of government that has given the United States a great amount of stability. There are a few democracies that have been around for 200 years, short as that time period is in the grand scheme of things. This is a way American national power has really benefited. And another way America has really been blessed by God. But now the left openly talks about getting rid of it. You have constitutional lawyers talking about saying things like, why should we care what the Constitution says? You have people talking about an evolving Constitution that basically means changing the Constitution until it means whatever we want it to mean. So these then are the 9 factors that Morgenthau talks about that go into national power. But what's really remarkable, I find, about this study is just, you know, where God says very specifically, I'm going to bless you in this area, and this area. And we've read those from the Bible. And then we can look at history, geography, and see that Britain and America have been blessed in exactly those areas. And then we can take an expert like Morgenthau and show and see how those blessings in those specific areas have led to those two nations rising and becoming great powers. And that it's those specific blessings that come directly from God that led to first Britain and then America becoming just these major powers. And then we look at the areas where God says again, very specifically, if you don't obey me, I will curse you in this area, and this area. And we see those exact areas again where America is weak. We see it first at the start, or at the beginning of the curses section of Leviticus 26, God says things like, well, I will break the pride of your power, you will spend your strength in vain. And what's implied from those kind of prophecies is that there's still power there, there's still strength there, but it's spent in vain. It's not used properly. The will and the leadership is broken. And that's exactly what we see right now. And there's a strong warning that comes even from going through these elements of national power from Morgenthau. Because you get some foreign policy experts that say, you know, look, America is a great power, and they're going to still be a great power 100 years from now. And they say, well, as we've talked about, they've got that amazing geography that they've been blessed with. America's got all those natural resources. And these type of experts say, well, that geography is not changing. Those natural resources are still there. America is just going to keep on being this great power for hundreds of at least decades. But then you look at Morgenthau, and Morgenthau says, well, out of all of these things that we've talked about, the most important isn't geography. It's the quality of diplomacy. It's how good the government and the other officials are at selecting and carrying out foreign policy in all these other different areas, things like national morale, military, government, even in industrial capacity, some of these other areas. He talks about the importance of leadership. And then what does the Bible say? Well, it's exactly those factors that Morgenthau identifies as most important. And it's those same factors as well that are the ones that can change the quickest that God is taking away right now. Now, if you keep reading Leviticus 26, God says more punishments are coming, that many of these other, well, all of these other factors will eventually be taken away of national power. But it's this leadership and quality of diplomacy, essentially, that is highlighted at the start of that curses section, that God takes away first. God is taking away those less stable but more important elements of national power. And the decline in those elements of national power, they negate all the advantages that the other elements of national power give. But then this study, at the same time, it shows us how to make America great again. It was blessings from God that made America great in the first place. We can trace that all the way from the Bible, through history, through Morgenthau, to applying it to the nation today. And now it is God who is bringing America down, who's weakening America, well, in response to our sins. And it is also, obviously, the sins of the people that are weakening the nation as well. But God is also actively, says in these scriptures that he will curse a nation that doesn't obey him. And that specifically the people of Israel that don't obey him. And so the way to make America great again is to turn back to God. And American presidents have understood this. Abraham Lincoln understood this. In his Lyceum address, he said, "We find ourselves in the peaceful possession of the fairest portion of the earth as regards fertility of soil, extent of territory, salubrity of climate." And as we've covered today, he wasn't just exaggerating when he said that. That is all provably true. He said, "We find ourselves the legal inheritors of these fundamental blessings. We toil not in the acquirement or establishment of them." In his Thanksgiving proclamation, he talked about the importance of recognizing the sublime truth announced in the Holy Scriptures and proven by all history, that those nations only are blessed whose God is the Lord. He said that we have been the recipients of the choicest blessings of heaven. We have been preserved these many years in peace and prosperity. We have grown in numbers, wealth, and power as no other nation has ever grown, but we have forgotten God. And he talks about how, because of the deceitfulness of our hearts, we've vainly imagined that these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. So Abraham Lincoln saw this exactly. He saw that it was these blessings from God that had led to American national power, and that this fall in power was coming as a consequence of disobedience to God. Now, this is a study of this subject is just a clear proof of how much God is in control of the world, how he's working out his plan. Mr. Armstrong wrote in the United States and Britain in Prophecy, one final quote from here, he said, "Do you know of stronger proof of the divine inspiration of the Holy Bible as the revealed word of the living God? Could mortal men have written without divine inspiration those prophecies we have considered in this book, made those promises to Joseph, Israel, and after a lapse of 2,520 years, beginning the exact year of 1800 to 1803, have the power to bring them about in fulfillment? These are no small or trifling promises. They involve possession of the great wealth and vast natural resources of the whole earth." So this subject also gives us great hope for the future. It shows us God is working things out. And the Bible says that it does say that if Israel refuses to turn to God, well, the curses do get much worse. But it ends with the whole earth turning to God, with God making America great again and a whole host of other nations great again. And if you'd like to know more about this, the United States and Britain in Prophecy is a great place to start, and it goes into all of these biblical prophecies in far more detail than I could. And as Mr. Armstrong said, is there any better proof of the Bible and of God's power? If you haven't read it, please do order it from our website, thetrumpet.com. We also have a relatively new free book, Great Again, by Mr. Gerald Flory that looks into how God is cursing America today, but where this is leading, what the hope is behind that. You can order both of those from our website at thetrumpet.com. That's about it from me. Don't forget, you can email us and send us any feedback about the show at td@kpcg.fm. Mr. Stephen Flory, I believe he should be back live from Edmond, Oklahoma tomorrow. So tune in next time for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.